Welcome to episode 46 of the 3M Fear podcast. Have you watched the movie Conjuring 3, The Devil Made Me Do It? In this episode, we are going to talk about the real story behind that movie. Now, the film begins with Ed and Lorraine Warren at the exorcism of a young boy named David Glatzel. Now, the real story is a lot similar to the movie, but not the exact story. In real life also, Ed and Lorraine Warren were present at the exorcism of a young boy named David Glatzel. But at the same time, there was another young boy, a 19-year-old boy, who was present at the exorcism. Allegedly, during the exorcism, Arnie asked the demon possessing David to enter him instead, and the demon accepted. Several weeks later, on February 16, 1981, Arnie stabbed his landlord, Alan Bono, to death after a drunken argument. The trial of Arnie Cheyenne Johnson, also known as the Devil Made Me Do It case, is the first known case in American history where the defense tried to prove innocence by saying that the person was possessed. So let's get into the trial of Arnie Cheyenne Johnson and understand what happened that led to this murder. Hello and welcome to the 3AM Fear podcast. I'm Nikita Farrow, mystery and thriller author. On this podcast, I talk about real crimes and real people. Due to the graphic nature of some of this content, listener discretion is advised. You can find the episode show notes on my website 3amfear.com. Let's get started. The story begins with the Glatzel family, a typical American household. Judy Glatzel was a mom, raising her children including Debbie and David. In 1980, seeking change, they decided to move into a rental property in Connecticut. They wanted to leave the busy streets of Bridgeport and move to a more quieter town. Now, Newtown, with its historical roots dating back to the 1700s, was filled with ancient churches and graveyards. It was a beautiful piece of history. But with this history came some paranormal activity. Debbie's parents, Judy and Carl, had concerns before moving and they weren't sure if they should do it. But despite all this, they decided to support their children and gave in some money to help them out. One day, while cleaning the house, before Debbie and Arnie moved in, the Glatzel brothers found an old canopy bed in the master bedroom. They decided to have some fun with it and started jumping up and down. However, as they were playing, the bedroom door slammed shut on its own. It scared them. After struggling for what seemed like hours, the door finally swung open. The brothers were shaken. Later, while cleaning around the bed, David, one of the Glatzel brothers, said that he saw an old man wearing a messy plaid shirt. The old man warned him to beware and pushed him onto the bed before suddenly disappearing. Terrified, David ran out and refused to rest for the rest of the day. That night, David shared his experience with his brother, describing the old man as real but equally terrifying. He said that he could still see the old man, but this time he was not just an old man. He was a monstrous beast with black, bottomless eyes, jagged teeth, pointed ears, devilish horns, and so much more. This encounter was the first of the many that were going to come. When David first mentioned about this incident, the couple thought that it was just his imagination. Maybe the boy didn't like the move and he just wanted to go back to his old house, and so he was making up the story. It was much later that they would realize how wrong they were. And this time, they too would hear something. After the unsettling experience at the house, the Glatzel family left their dog, George, there overnight and then left. But when they returned the next day, they found the dog terrified, with claw marks on the basement door, as if he was desperately trying to escape from something. As said, when David had first told his family about what he saw, his family just dismissed it, thinking that this boy just didn't want to move and that's what he was feeling. But he would later go on to tell the same story to Arnie, Debbie's boyfriend. And Arnie had found scratches on the basement door, confirming that whatever David saw or heard were true. The dog seemed afraid and it looked like it had seen something that it shouldn't have. David also spoke with Karen, the previous tenant who was moving out. She shared her own chilling experience with the old man. She also had seen him and she was so afraid that she wanted to leave. She even told the story of the night when the old man appeared on her bed and tried to touch her with his icy cold fingers. Concerned about all these things that happened, Debbie and Arnie reconsidered moving in. They weren't sure if what they were doing was right. They started packing to leave. But Arnie's mother, who had just moved out of her apartment to live with them, arrived. And now they had no other option. They dismissed all this and decided to stay and hope for the best. In the days following their departure from the rental house, eerie occurrences became frequent for the Glatzel family. David increasingly became distressed. He said that he could still see that old man, and no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't forget him. His terrors became worse and the family didn't know how to help him or how to protect him. Just imagine, David was an 11-year-old boy. An 11-year-old boy struggling to understand why he could see this one man that no one in his family could. And even if they did, how could they help him? Because according to everyone, this man never existed or this man doesn't exist. What's even more scary is that this entity came out from an ancient well on the property. The home that they were living in was one that carried a lot of history, and homes with such histories often have mysterious things attached to them. David's panic peaked when he shouted about this old man reaching their front door. Three loud knocks echoed through the walls. And this time, Judy heard it too. Desperate, she tried holy water to repel the entity. But David insisted that it found its way to the attic. There they started hearing these unsettling noises. Banging, scratching, objects moving. By now, the entire family was sure that something was in the house. Despite all this terror, Arnie said that he would go into the attic and find out what was happening. He bravely walked in and found only dusty boxes. There was pin drop silence. He felt this chill run down his spine and this distant voices of whisper, but nothing more. It seemed as if there was someone present there, and yet this entity was not letting Arnie know who it was. The situation became even worse when David claimed that the old man now had 42 helpers with him. And these 42 helpers helped spill out boxes Arnie brought into the rental house. David's descriptions of the demonic entities became vivid and disturbing. He narrated the scary appearance of each entity, bloody and malformed. He even said that they carried these imaginary weapons. They would try to come and attack him and stop just before it touched him. He said that it kind of seemed like they were testing the waters to see how far they could go. The family, hoping for some psychological explanation, witnessed a dreadful turn of events. The torture and assault on David continued. The old man demanded for David's soul, offering to spare him if he surrendered. But David said no, he would never surrender his soul to the old man. And because of this, the old man was so angry that he started being violent and would start beating David by invisible entities. And all these beatings left visible marks on the body. There were welts, bruises, and even signs of strangulation. The sound of this physical abuse was audible, so every family member could hear what was happening with David. But they couldn't help him. David suffered through strangulation, gasping for air as the visible assailant attacked. During these terrifying episodes, the father, Carl, who was a mechanic, was so busy with his work that he didn't know what was happening in his own house. As for David's elder brother, Carl Jr., he refused to believe that whatever David was telling was true, and he just mocked David, laughed at him, and said that he was just making stories up because he wanted attention. Desperate for help, Judy Glatzel turned to the church, and Father James Tennis at St. Joseph's Church was a savior. Or at least, that's what she thought. Although Father Dennis was sympathetic, he hesitated. Apparently, Father Dennis had participated in an exorcism years ago, and the toll that it took on him, he didn't want to do it again, and so he refused to help. The family's distress intensified as they tried to ask help from the church, begging them to protect their son and to put him out of his misery. Now, Father Dennis couldn't help David on his own, but he did suggest two people who could help them, and that were the Warrens, Ed and Lorraine Warren. Edward Warren was a popular demonologist, and Lorraine Warren was a medium. Together, they had founded NESPER. Ed and Lorraine Warren, known for their extensive work in paranormal investigations and exorcisms, were said to be the go-to people if you needed an exorcism or if you needed to find out whether your place was haunted. Now, the Glatzels were desperate for help. They needed someone who would believe them and would also help them protect their son. So when the father advised them to go to Ed and Lorraine Warren, they jumped to it. From here on, I'll play a few recordings in between, which basically are clips from the interview of Ed and Lorraine Warren and what they had to say about this incident.
Yeah, what I'd like to do is start off, if I could, with you, Lorraine. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved in this case right from the start?
We were contacted by Father Dennis, who at that time was pastor of St. Joseph's Church in Brookfield, Tony. Mm-hmm. And the call came in, and he spoke about a young boy who he had been trying to help, but recognized it as a case of possession. He told me that he was very leery of becoming involved in this case, mm-hmm, because he had been assigned by the bishop to exorcise another home, but this was not of an individual now, of a home that had infestation going on that we investigated. But he said, I want you to know that you have my prayers.
When Lorraine Warren came to visit David, she saw this black mist next to him, and that's when she realized that there was someone with him. Debbie and her mother told the Warrens how they had witnessed David being beaten, strangled, and tortured for days on end. Now know that the Warrens entered the house 12 days after the initial torture began, which means David was bearing this torture for 12 days. At this point, by the time the Warrens came, David had started to growl, hiss, speak in otherworldly voices, recite passages from the Bible or Paradise Lost. As said, mostly when people are possessed, they start speaking in Latin. The Glatzel started narrating the incidents, whatever happened to David. They would say the torture that he went through, the words that he would speak, the things that he would do. It just didn't make sense. Now, Lorraine Warren initially said that she needed to know everything because she wanted to know whether this was an actual possession or if there was something wrong with David. Maybe he had a condition which looked like a possession, but it wasn't. This is exactly why when the Warrens came, they were accompanied by Dr. Anthony Shen Grasso. Again, this was because they wanted to make sure that this was actually a demonic possession and not a health condition that looked like a demonic possession. Now, the Warrens had over 25 years of experience involving over 400 exorcisms. Looking at David's condition, they had to be sure that this was also a demonic possession. And again, even if they had to do an exorcism, Ed and Lorraine Warren never did this exorcism on their own. They weren't priests. They always had a priest with them, and the priest would perform the exorcism. The job of Ed and Lorraine Warren was to find out whether the person was actually possessed or whether there was a ghost or a demon in the house. They would then call in the priest, and the priest would perform the exorcism while the Warrens were present. When they arrived at the house, the evening took a strange turn. As they approached the house, both Ed and Lorraine Warren, as well as Dr. Grasso, suddenly tripped on the steps. It seemed like someone had pushed them from behind. Inside, the tension was still thick in the air. David, who didn't know that they tripped outside, actually told them that he knew that they tripped outside. Now, the Warrens hadn't even told David that they tripped, but somehow David seemed to know that it happened with them. The Warrens interviewed the Glatzel family, finding them sincere and frightened. Lorraine described their initial encounter with David, noticing there was a small change in his behavior. During Ed's interview with David, Lorraine Warren witnessed a disturbing occurrence. As I said before, she saw this black mist that formed around David, signaling that someone or something was present with them. Lorraine further sensed that the entity had appeared to be a very powerful mass that was centered around David. When she asked about this entity's location, whatever David said aligned with what she had seen in her psychic vision. Suddenly, a dramatic outbreak of poltergeist activity unfolded in front of everyone. There were loud knocks and tapping noises throughout the house. Objects started levitating and moving without any cause. Even the leather belt and a flower vase flew across the room, demonstrating that someone wanted to be seen. The demon was here. Attempting to communicate, Ed Warren engaged with the entity, asking this entity to respond with maybe loud bangs or taps. Now, through this conversation, the entity said that it was Satan and David was a medium. Now, knowing that demons tend to lie, Ed wasn't sure that if this was actually Satan. He thought that it was someone else just posing as Satan. Now, with so much that happened in the house, the Warrens realized that David was actually under attack, and they needed to free him from whatever entity this was. Concerned for the family's safety, they explained the severity of the situation to the Glatzel family. They said that, "You have seen firsthand what happened to your son, and we need to go to the Roman Catholic Church in order to do an exorcism." After that day, the Glatzel family home would never be the same. Strange things would happen from time to time. Objects would be thrown around, strange noises would be heard, voices would echo through the rooms. There would even be these cloven hoof prints and claw-like attacks on the walls. Even toys seemed to be possessed. There was a plastic toy dinosaur that started speaking to David, warning him that there would be severe punishment if the Warrens didn't leave. The demon was aware of how dangerous the Warrens would be. And if the Warrens went to the church, then there was no escape from the demon. And so the demon wanted to do everything in its power to stop the Warrens from what they were doing. It started creating more and more problems for the family. The eldest Glatzel boy, Carl Jr., became a target for the demon. Carl, who once didn't believe that there was something wrong with David or that there was an entity in the house, now had no escape. The family frequently faced heated arguments. There would also be physical fights in the family. David revealed that several demons targeted Carl Jr., whispering in his ears, provoking him to start a fight with his family. The Warrens concluded that Carl Jr. was under demonic attack. Right now, the demon's aim seemed to be to separate the family, to make sure that they were not together so they couldn't fight the demon together. The torture against David continued. He suffered so many assaults. His hair was violently torn, forced to perform exorcisms until vomiting, choked by unseen hands, and subjected to sleep deprivation. There were instances of levitation. On his 12th birthday, the demons attacked him. Instead of celebrating, he was being violently attacked, and that day was no fun for him. Despite efforts to protect David, the family found themselves trying to protect each other from fights, praying to God for his safety. By now, David's behavior took a drastic turn. He was no longer this sweet, kind little boy. He hissed, uttered bad words, quoted literature, and even spoke in a language that neither he nor anyone else in the family knew. Now let's shift the focus to another young man, Arnie Johnson. Arnie had been dating David's sister Debbie for a while. The family asked him to move in and support David through all his nightmares. Arnie moved in around May of 1980 and quickly became a part of the family. He genuinely wanted to help David, but nothing he did seemed to help the boy. Now during the last exorcism attempt, Arnie got so frustrated that he boldly challenged the spirits to come and attack him instead. He offered the spirits to come and go into his body so that David could be free. Now remember, Arnie and David were close friends, and Arnie was just 19 years old at this time. Ed Warren knew that the spirits were unpredictable, and he knew that even though Arnie may or may not believe whatever was happening, he asked them to come and enter his body, he knew that the repercussions would not be good, and so he tried to stop him. But by the time Arnie had opened his mouth, it was too late. Now the thing about the spirits is that they don't immediately attack or immediately show themselves. It takes them time. And that's exactly what they did in Arnie's case. This boldness that Arnie showed in order to protect David turned out to be a grave mistake. After the exorcism, even though Arnie immediately didn't show any signs, the Warrens were afraid, and so they immediately informed the police to monitor him because they were afraid that something might happen to him. Tragically, David succumbed to full demonic possession on September 8th. His appearance distorted. He attempted to attack his family members with various objects, even causing physical harm. Carl Sr., his father, who initially didn't believe about all these things, now was faced with the truth. But it was too late. There was nothing that he could do to help his boy. The family's delayed acknowledgement caused even more problems for David. Unfortunately, after David had completely been possessed by spirits, that his father believed that something was happening. Now the whole story about the demon exiting David's body and getting into Arnie's body is written in the book The Devil in Connecticut by Gerald Brittle. Upon Carl Sr.'s realization that his son was now being forced by these spirits, he was lost. He didn't know how to protect his family. The Glatzel family collectively acknowledged that now it was too late. They had to do something. As the terrifying occurrences continued, the Warrens contacted the Archdiocese of Bridgeport to report the family's torture. Acting Bishop Walter Curtis dispatched a team of priests, including Father Francis Verger Locke of Stamford, to investigate. During the investigation, shocking things unfolded. A sight of David levitating left Father Grasso so horrified that it renewed his faith in God. Despite initial skepticism, the priest now acknowledged that the Warrens were right and they had to do something. Now, even though David was said to be possessed, a major exorcism wasn't initially authorized by the bishop. Instead, they were delivering small sessions. That is, instead of doing one major exorcism, they were doing several small exorcisms. Mini exorcisms. But these mini rites of exorcisms failed to remove these demons. This led to violent episodes where David would show superhuman strength, requiring multiple individuals to restrain him to the bed. Father Werger Locke led these exorcism attempts, threatening the spirit to leave David's body and to leave the boy alone. The priests involved faced extreme trauma. At one point, they themselves were targeted by the entity. They had to suffer assaults and even torment. Despite the failure of the deliverance sessions, Bishop Curtis had not granted permission for a full proper exorcism. This led to even more delay and even worser condition for David. The Warrens urgently emphasized the critical need for an exorcism, saying that it's getting out of hand. They needed help. David needed help. At one point, the Warrens even warned the Brookfield Police Department of potential violence, of something bad to come. Now getting back to Arnie and Debbie moved into their own place. And soon after they moved in, Arnie started experiencing similar symptoms to what David was experiencing initially. He would go into trances, growl, and mention seeing this beast. And later when asked, he would have no memory of seeing this beast. Ed and Lorraine Warren, who were then notified about this, they blamed Arnie for it. They said, "We did warn you not to go there, but you still did." Even then, they decided to help him. 4 months before Arnie would be arrested, Lorraine Warren warned the police about a dark energy that was surrounding the family. She experienced concern for anyone coming closer to them and said that everyone should be warned. This family was in danger for themselves and for others. Debbie and Arnie, who had now rented a small apartment from a man named Alan Bono near the Glatzel home, were living a happy life, with small issues of course. Arnie and Alan had become close friends, spending time together at the bar, and after moving in, something happened. Arnie's behavior towards him changed. He began acting oddly. He would experience these memory lapses and strange states, like he would just stare. Before this, Arnie was a regular guy. He loved sports, he loved spending time with his family and friends. Everyone knew how compassionate and how sweet he was. However, on February 16, 1981, something terrible happened. On February 16, 1981, Arnie Johnson skipped work and decided to join Debbie, his sister Wanda, and Debbie's young cousin Mary at the kennel where they all worked. The landlord, Alan Bono, took them for lunch at a bar and drank heavily. Afterward, they returned to the kennel. When Debbie took the girls out for pizza, she sensed some trouble. She hurried back. Alan Bono was now completely drunk and was upset. Tension rose in the air. Mary was now caught in Bono's grip. Arnie tried to protect her and pull her away, but Bono would not let her go. Despite trying to solve this problem, it just got worse, until Arnie started growling and he pulled out a 5-inch knife and attacked Bono. Bono would be rushed to the hospital, but he would succumb to his wounds and die. Arnie was found a couple of miles away from the scene. He was immediately arrested. But when he was found, he seemed confused. He had no memory of him stabbing Alan Bono. After learning about Bono's death, Johnson became incoherent and fell asleep briefly. He was then charged with first-degree murder and held at the Bridgeport Correctional Center, marking the first unlawful killing in Brookfield, Connecticut's history. Now, something to know about Alan Bono is that Debbie was hired by him to work as a dog groomer at the Brookfield Pet Motel. She and Arnie were given the adjacent apartment to rent, and that's how Bono became their employer and landlord. He was said to be a sweet guy. In fact, Arnie and Alan Bono were good friends. It's just that no one knows what happened that night. Why did Arnie suddenly attack Bono? I mean, of course, Alan Bono was drunk, and according to reports, he was acting a little crazy. But what made Arnie stab him? That question is not answered. Because accordingly in the court, Arnie would later go on to say that the devil made him do it. Because he was possessed with whatever David was possessed with. Wanda, in an interview with the Washington Post, would later say, quote, "I can't explain it. It just broke. That's all." End quote. Now that Arnie was arrested, Debbie desperately called her parents, begging them to come and help. Carl Sr. and Judy rushed to the scene, where paramedics tried to save Alan, but they couldn't. Judy Glatzel, David's mother, would later speak about her son's involvement in all of this and would say that her son was not the only one who succumbed to this temptation and that Arnie was also going through the same thing that David went through. The day after the killing, Lorraine Warren informed the Brookfield police that this was the devil doing and that Arnie was possessed. The media soon took over the story. They took whatever the Warren said, whatever Judy had to say, and that's how the whole story became a book, a movie. It detailed all the gruesome things that happened and said, the devil made him do it. Judy Glatzel expressed a belief that the world was under the control of the devil, pointing at various societal issues as evidence. The Warrens supported the Glatzel family, saying that Arnie was overtaken by this demonic spirit and that when David's exorcism was going on, Arnie stepped forward and said, "Take me," and that's when the spirits took them and which finally led to the murder. Arnie's trial became wildly famous and it was dubbed the Demon Murder Trial or the Devil Made Me Do It case. Beginning on October 28th, 1981, Arnie's defense team shifted tactics, claiming that this was self-defense. The court clearly dismissed the claims of demonic possession, saying that this was not something that they could act on. And so the next thing that Arnie's team said was that this was self-defense. The jury were not allowed to consider the idea of demonic possession. They based their verdict solely on Arnie's past and whatever evidence that they could find on the crime scene. He was found not guilty of murder, but he was found guilty of manslaughter in the first degree. He was sentenced to 10 to 20 years, but he served less than a quarter of that, being released after just 5 years. In 1985, Arnie Johnson and Debbie Glatzel got married in prison. Arnie was released a year later for good behavior, having served his 5 years. The pair stayed together until Debbie's death in 2021. Now let's come to the interesting part here. Lorraine Warren said that the profits of the book were shared with the family. But according to the sources, only $2,000 were paid to the family. Upon the book's republication in 2006 by iUniverse, David Glatzel and Carl Jr. sued the authors and the book publishers for violating their rights to privacy. Carl also claimed that the book put in a lot of details that he didn't allow. He said that the whole possession story was not true and that this was some story written by Ed and Lorraine Warren and that the possession never happened in the first place. By possession, I mean David's possession, not Arnie's. He would also go on to say that the book made a completely different story out of his brother's mental illness, and the book also showed Carl Jr. as someone who was a joke because he didn't believe in demonic possession. He would further go on to say that the Warrens told them that their story would make them millionaires, but the only people who actually profited from this whole thing were the Warrens. The families didn't get anything. Now I want to mention something here because this is kind of a debate. A lot of people aren't sure whether Carl was telling the truth or not and whether the Warrens actually promised them money, whether the Warrens actually gave them money, because unfortunately the Warrens are not alive today to present their case. But I have already done an episode on the Conjuring movie, the real story behind the Conjuring movie. And in that, the first Conjuring movie, the family in that also presented a similar case. They said that the Warrens came, tried to repel the demon, tried to get the demon out of their family, but they couldn't. And then they just left. And after they left, they made this whole Conjuring universe, they sold the story, they made a lot of money from the books. But the actual people who suffered didn't get anything. In fact, the daughter in that family also wrote a book of her own. Unfortunately, even she said that she didn't get much from her own book as much as Ed and Lorraine Warren got from their movie. She also said that Ed and Lorraine Warren had changed a lot of things in the story, and that the Conjuring movie and the real story were a lot different. So what do you think? Do you think that this whole thing could have been a hoax? Carl Jr. seems to think that it was a hoax. Another interesting thing to be noted is that there were a lot of priests who were there while this exorcism was happening, or at least that's the story that was told. But not a single priest came forward and said that, yes, this exorcism happened, we have seen this entity, this is the haunting. None of the priests came forward and said anything. Now, we are not sure if it is because the church won't allow them or if actually nothing happened. In 2007, David and Carl Glatzel pressed charges against the Warren family, accusing them of profiting from David's story without permission. They claimed that there was no demonic possession, suggesting that the Warrens just made up the story for fame and that Carl's brother David was actually going through some mental illness which the Warrens labeled as a possession. There was even a book published called The Devil in Connecticut in 1983, which later turned into the movie Conjuring 3. The Warrens would give out multiple interviews, the clips of one that I have added in this podcast, and also I'll add the link so you can watch the entire interview where the Warrens just claimed to say that this was true, this was what happened, and they helped the Glatzel family. Not much is known about what happened to Arnie, even though Arnie and Debbie always supported the Warrens. They always stood by the Warrens and they always said that, yes, the possession did happen, the Warrens helped them out, and Debbie was there even when the film shooting was taking place. Not much is known about Arnie after he was released. Lorraine Warren said in 1986 that Arnie was ready to work for a landscaper in town and he's coming home to live in a very good family atmosphere. Now coming back to Carl. Carl openly said that his brother was not possessed. In fact, David also said that he was not possessed. This was all some mental illness, which was later titled as possession. But one interesting thing to be noted here is that Carl disagreed that the murder of Alan Bono was because of possession. Quote, "There's nothing demonic in this. Arnie was very possessive of Debbie. There were speculations and rumors that Debbie was having an affair with Alan Bono." End quote. This brought out a question, a few questions as a matter of fact. And I would like you to think about it and let me know if you think this is true. If this is up in YouTube and you're listening to it, I would definitely love to know your answers in the comments. Do you think that Arnie killed Alan Bono in anger, knowing that his wife was having an affair, or he thought that his wife was having an affair, and he deemed this whole thing as demonic possession because the Warrens had already put this idea in his head because of whatever happened with David? Because Carl and David seemed to believe that there was no demonic possession happening. The Warrens were sure that there was a demonic possession, and Arnie seems to believe that this murder was committed because whatever was inside David came out and went inside Arnie when Arnie asked the spirit to enter him. So what do you think? Do you think that Arnie was very possessive and that out of spite or out of anger he did this and then titled it as a demonic possession? Now, apparently, after the trial, Ed and Lorraine Warren hired this author, Gerald Brittle, to write the book, A Devil in Connecticut, as I said. The movie came from the book. All these sources have come from the documentary. I'll link the documentary also in the description. You can watch it. I have already summarized everything in this episode, but if you want more information, you can always watch the documentary. Now, according to the documentary, after the trial, Ed and Lorraine Warren hired an author, Gerald Brittle, to write David and Arnie's story. Carl said in the film, quote, Ed said, make it scary. And Gerald goes, but I checked with the people and they said this didn't happen. Ed goes, make it scary. People come to us, they buy scary. End quote. Now, according to the documentary, the Glatzel parents received $4,500 for selling their story, while the Warrens, wait for it, got more than $81,000. Now, four of the Glatzel siblings are scattered, they rarely keep in contact, and after their parents' death, Carl started sorting through the belongings, and while he was searching through the belongings, he found something quite interesting. Now, in this belongings, he found a note from his mother. That note said, quote, well, the family had their medicine tonight and everything was good. End quote. Now, Carl believes that his mother might be drugging their family. And by drugging, I mean giving them this medicine called Sominex, which is a sleep aid. You put it in the food and it helps you go to sleep. Carl would go on to say, quote, but Sominex has long-lasting effects on people, mood swings, weight gain, and hallucinations. It is very possible that my brother David had ingested enough of his stuff over the years where he did see things, or at least he thought he saw things. End quote. This possibility was raised much later on that maybe the mother was actually drugging their food. David had enough and then he started seeing things that weren't there. But if that is true, if the mother was actually drugging the children and whatever David saw was just hallucinations, he was having some side effects, what does that say about Arnie's whole case? Arnie believes and says that he killed Alan Bono because he was possessed by the devil, the same devil that came out of David and went inside him. But if there was no devil, if David was never possessed, if it was just a side effect of medicine, then what about Arnie? Was he possessed? Or did he believe he was possessed? I will end this episode with this one question and let you think about it. A big thank you to all my fellow listeners who have been listening to all my episodes. Thank you so much. Your listens, your support means a lot. If you love my podcast, if you love the stories that I put out, then please do follow me on whichever podcasting platform you are listening from. And please do leave a rating. It will really help me a lot. You can listen to me on other platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and any other podcasting platform. If you are in India, you can always listen to my podcast on Gaana or JioSaavn. If you love to listen to strange and mysterious stories, then follow me on Instagram and YouTube, where I put out reels on such stories. These are completely different from the ones that I put out on my podcast, so do follow me on them. If you love travel, you can follow me on my travel channels. I'll link them also in the description. Until then, stay kind and stay safe out there.